Thank you, Rosetta, and thank you so much to everyone for inviting me to spend this evening and tomorrow here at Smith and to speak to the members of the Kahn Institute. I'm very excited, as I've told a few people. When you're provost, people tend to forget that you're also a scholar, and that maybe there's a reason why you had all those years behind you, so I'm especially pleased to be invited to speak on my scholarship. And thank you also, Rosetta, for setting up why we're going to be talking about 1963 as a particular year. Also, as a historian, I have that bad habit of reading, but trust me that it will keep me on time. So if you will forgive me for reading, it will help me organize my thoughts, and I'll try to be engaging as I do so. So the year 1963 was a complicated and interesting time for women in the United States. In many ways, the country felt comfortable with a steady economy, a growing population, and a lively new Democratic president, John Kennedy. But in other areas, the nation was neither as calm or confident. Concern over civil rights continued to surface, and the Cold War certainly created national anxiety. Women's issues were generally quiet, although excitement had been generated by the Kinsey Report findings about sexual activity and through attention to the proposed Equal Rights Amendment. In just a few years, that quiet feeling of 1963 would give way to urban race riots, the assassination of that charismatic president, and the rise of a new women's liberation movement. Many women in 1963 might not have realized exactly how tenuous a balance they were striking, but in retrospect, they and we can see the beginnings of change for women during that time. 1963 was generally, genuinely, a year on the cusp of transformation. So as such, 1963 offers us a very useful lens for examining advocacy on behalf of women. Although women's issues had generally been quiet in the post-World War II era, there had been some efforts to examine women's needs. As I already said, the two reports by the Kinsey researchers brought new notice to the sexual activity and needs of women, whether married or single. Several books such as the National Manpower Council's Woman Power and Work in the Lives of Married Women had explored women's role and potential in the workplace. Women's psychological difficulties in managing modern expectations had been highlighted in Modern Woman, the Lost Sex, and A Generation of Vipers. In education, a women's college president wrote Educating Our Daughters as a way to advocate certain curricular choices, and a 10-year commission at the American Council on Education had studied the collegiate needs of women. Among these various works, two books appeared in 1963 that, for me, crystallized the issues around women in that changeable era. Betty Friedan's blockbuster, The Feminine Mystique, was published by A Popular Press. And in that same year, the U.S. government released the report of the President's Commission on the Status of Women, chartered 2 years earlier by John F. Kennedy. Now, I have to have a little truth in advertising here. The book that I'm going to read from and show you, this report of the President's Commission actually came out in 1965, but I get away with it by saying that the report of the Commission itself came out in 1963. What they did was added some material, which I'll describe, and so this book, which is most generally used, actually was not 1963, but I'm convinced my point still holds, so you can disagree with me if you wish, but I think it's still legitimate. Friedan's book, as you know, became central in the women's movement. In fact, The Feminine Mystique is often credited with sparking the movement. Now, the commission's report, as I just mentioned, was later released as American Women, the Report of the President's Commission on the Status of Women. It was well read at the time, but has since taken on prominence as a benchmark, the first national study of women's concerns. In fact, many readers today imagine American Women as a much more feminist analysis than it actually is. Although different in many ways, these two books highlight the issues faced by those thinking about women in the early 1960s. Ultimately, they offer different analyses and different solutions for women's concerns, yet each captures the challenges and thinking of an era that found no clear answers for how to support women. In 1963, it was hardly clear whether the future would proceed along its same path or go in the new directions that Friedan was hailing. Let me first outline a few of the key differences and similarities of these two books, and you can keep my outline in mind as I then move to examine each one in more detail. My goal is to explicate two themes. The first is that, although our own post-feminist perspective leads us to consider Friedan as better capturing the era, I suggest that the Presidential Commission report actually presents a truer picture of female agency in 1963. Although Friedan's bold call for collective action characterized the era that would follow, the presidential commissioners more accurately represent well-intentioned thinkers caught in a delicate balancing act between women's personal choice and public change in this early part of the decade. My second theme comes from examining how the books treat women's education, an aspect often overlooked by scholars. I will suggest that although neither book intended itself as an exploration of education, each found there a useful tool for examining contemporary dilemmas and offering potential solutions. So let me now give you an overview of the two books. At first glance, The Feminine Mystique in American Women seemed vastly different. Friedan was the sole author of her lengthy analysis of how and why American women were trapped in dull, unambitious lives. This small paperback edition that I use is over 400 pages of very, very dense print. By contrast, American Women was written by members and consultants of the President's Commission. Its basic report was a mere 100 pages, although the edited and published version does contain additional reports from subcommittees. Friedan follows a carefully plotted path through her explanations of women's situation. The Commission's report, on the other hand, feels disjointed and fragmentary. Friedan's writing swirls with passion and sometimes feels almost stream of consciousness. The Commission report is dry and analytical, with a few mildly successful attempts at rousing language. Finally, Friedan is unabashedly feminist in her analysis and her proposed solutions. The commissioners, many of whom were feminist-minded, tiptoe around feminism, trying to appeal to all readers without offending any. Yet, in their analyses and their impacts, these two works have more in common than might immediately be apparent. Highlighting these similarities helps clarify the rather complex moment for women in 1963. Although the styles are different, they are nonetheless both pieces of advocacy with political overtones. The politics in the Commission report are obvious. President Kennedy wished to highlight the gains American women had made over time, and equally important, to appeal to female voters. Friedan's politics are more personal. Before advocates had coined the term that the personal is political, Friedan was laying out an argument that issues affecting women as individuals also affected the wider culture. Yet the real advocacy of the President's Commission should not be minimized. Theirs was indeed the work of the first national level group to examine women's issues and to offer specific recommendations for improvement. Both books also rely on research. Because Friedan's book was ultimately treated as a manifesto, it's easy to forget the depth of her research, ranging from studies of psychology to workforce analyses to personal interviews. The President's Commission also used research gathered by its subcommittees, seeing its report as the opportunity to summarize extant knowledge about women's concerns. Finally, both books demonstrate a surprising reliance on education as a central theme, one that both explains women's condition and offers them amelioration. The fact that both stop short of acknowledging or summoning the full potential of education is, I argue, an artifact of the era, which in itself provides an important finding. So let me first take us through the work of the President's Commission as an outline for the book. John Kennedy created the President's Commission in 1961 for three reasons, none of which was highlighted openly in the executive order which established it. There, the President emphasized national interest, women's long service, and the need to strengthen family security. But Kennedy's political reasoning included, first, the great contribution of women's votes to his close win in 1960. Kennedy saw the Commission as a useful way of acknowledging women's support. Second, he wished to emphasize American women's strengths and successes in contrast to Soviet achievements. In an era rampant with such cross-national comparisons, he hoped to trumpet U.S. women's freedom as compared to Soviet restrictions. Third, Kennedy wished to steer focus away from the nagging notion of the Equal Rights Amendment. Kennedy and his advisors did not favor the ERA, but they also did not wish to seem uncommitted to women's issues. Thus, a commission to address inequities could be politically useful. The commission was organized by Esther Peterson, a longtime labor leader and women's advocate who was serving as Kennedy's Assistant Secretary of Labor and Director of the U.S. Women's Bureau. Like many both inside and outside Kennedy's administration, Peterson recognized various political, economic, and legislative inequities facing women. She had addressed many of these through a long history as a labor union lobbyist, including service with the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America and the Industrial Union Department of the AFL-CIO. Peterson was committed to a long-standing approach of using protective labor legislation for women, sometimes called specific bills for specific ills. Here, problems such as forced overtime that disadvantaged working mothers, or rules limiting weights that could be lifted on a job, were addressed via appropriate national, state, or local legislation. Adherents of this approach believed that such individually tailored remedies were the best way to balance protection and opportunity for working women. The Equal Rights Amendment, on the other hand, had been promulgated as a sweeping, generalized statement that men and women would be treated equally. Its actual language seemed innocuous. Quote, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Yet, to its opponents, the amendment threatened women's gains. The ERA actually had little active support in the early 1960s. The National Woman's Party was the only organized group that was visibly advocating for it. But the continuing activism prompted opponents like Peterson to search for new ways to address problems in the workforce without the ERA. Because the commission originated from the Labor Department, and because labor legislation was a key concern, it emphasized employment and wage issues. Kennedy charged to, quote, review progress and make recommendations in several areas: employment policies and practices, both in the federal government and private companies; federal Social Security and tax laws that affected women; federal and state level labor laws; and differences in legal treatment of women and men, quote, in regard to political and civil rights, property rights, and family relations. A catch-all last area was, quote, new and expanded services that might be required for women as wives, mothers, and workers. Now, this last could include education, childcare, counseling, and job training. Although subsequently the commission was remembered as a general status of women report, it was intended to focus on labor legislation, tax regulations, and workforce concerns. 26 people, 15 women and 11 men, were recruited to serve as commissioners, several from key government posts and others from important unions and labor organizations. It included the Secretaries of Labor, Agriculture, Commerce, and Health, Education, and Welfare. Governmental appointments also included two U.S. senators, two congresspersons, the U.S. Attorney General, and the chairman of the Civil Service Commission. Other influential members included leaders from the AFL-CIO and the National Electricians Union, several from education, the editor of a Ladies' Home Journal, and the heads of the National Councils of Negro Women, Catholic Women, and Jewish Women. To chair the commission, Kennedy recruited one of the most famous women in America, Eleanor Roosevelt, who was not actually a Kennedy supporter. Nevertheless, Roosevelt's stature gave the commission immediate notoriety. Unfortunately, Roosevelt died midway through the commission's 2 years of work, and Peterson assumed a larger role from behind the scenes. In the public mind, however, the commission remained identified with Roosevelt, and as you can see, her picture appeared on the back cover of the public report. The commission met 8 times during its 2-year tenure, but most of the work was done in subcommittees. The original plan was for 5 subgroups. For 6 subgroups. The first 5 were to address economic issues, including federal employment, government contracts, federal tax and social insurance, protective labor legislation, civil and political rights. The 6th area of new and expanded services was split into 2 during the commission's first meeting, one group to focus on home and community concerns and the other on education. Breaking into committees also allowed the commission to expand its reach by inviting experts onto these subgroups. For instance, the Education Subcommittee was chaired by Commission member Mary Bunting, president of Radcliffe College. The 14 members that Bunting and Peterson recruited were not members of the larger commission, but they brought educational expertise. The commission also created 2 gatherings that it called consultations, one on media issues, to which Betty Friedan was a consultant, and the other on concerns specific to African American women. The potentially divisive issue of the ERA was avoided when Peterson orchestrated its discussion into the Subcommittee on Civil and Political Rights. Once that subcommittee agreed to handle the ERA, the others were freed for their more specific work. Most of those economically oriented committees identified special measures or rules that were causing issues for women and provided recommendations for change. So when the entire commission convened to hear progress reports, the subcommittees provided lists of issues to be voted on. At the final two-day meeting in April 1963, the commissioners voted on a long list of suggestions, ranging from a call for equal pay for comparable work, to gender equality in jury service, to encouragement for women to run for public office. Now, let me focus a little bit more specifically on the report itself. Education had been an afterthought in the original conception of the President's Commission. Yet in the final report to the American public, education played a primary role and came first in its list of reports. American Women opened with an invitation to action that explained the Commission's goal of advancing the greater development of women's potential and fuller use of their present abilities. Now, a common post-war theme was women's contribution to national prosperity, and the Commission intended to highlight that relationship. The report turned immediately to its overall point that women, because of the vast freedoms in America, had both the opportunity and the responsibility to choose the direction of their lives. Quote, "We believe that one of the greatest freedoms of the individual in a democratic society is the freedom to choose among different life patterns." Now, how would a woman make a choice? The commission tried to address women in every circumstance, as you can see. I'll read that lengthy quote. "Illumined by values transmitted through home and school and church, society and heritage, and informed by present and past experience, each woman must arrive at her contemporary expression of purpose, whether as center of home and family, a participant in the community, a contributor to the economy, a creative artist or thinker or scientist, a citizen engaged in politics and public service. Part and parcel of this freedom is the obligation to assume corresponding responsibility." Now, the commission did admit that not all American women were equally free to make choices. It quoted, "For example, the city slum and the poor rural crossroad frustrate natural gifts and innate human powers." And it quickly explained that what it called the social climate could affect women, including the issues it was also treating in employment practices, social insurance, tax provisions, and labor laws. Then the report offered a fascinating statement that had, in fact, never appeared in transcripts of the commission's public meetings. The commission asserted that, quote, "As our work progressed, we became convinced that greater public understanding of the value of continuing education for all mature Americans is perhaps the highest priority item on the American agenda." In the early 1960s, education was being identified as an important lever for social and economic change. In Kennedy's New Frontier and then in Johnson's Great Society, education was being seen as a way to level the playing field for people of different circumstances. If equality of outcome could not be guaranteed across differing gender, racial, and economic groups, then perhaps equality of opportunity could work from the opposite end. As scholars worked to understand the causes and conditions of poverty, education emerged as a controllable set of inputs that could provide equal opportunities for students' talents and strengths to blossom. Although the commission had been formed primarily to address economic, legal, and political concerns, its members quickly seemed to recognize the equalizing potential of education. The report declared that, quote, "good basic instruction and quality of early education should be available to all American youth," and it recommended better preparation of teachers. Following the lead of its education subcommittee, the commission addressed most of its recommendations to adult education and collegiate schooling. The commission recognized that over a century's time, the lifespan of Americans had greatly expanded. In 1900, a newborn girl could expect to live to age 48. But by 1963, girls' life expectancy had risen to 73 years. Mothers could expect to spend decades in the workforce. Better basic education was needed for the 4 million adult women who would have less than 5 years of schooling over their lifetimes. But the report argued equity did not significantly improve as women moved up the educational ladder. Quote, "Once the college level is reached, the girls begin to fall behind. In 1962, women constituted 42% of the entering collegiate class, but were earning only one in three of all the bachelor's and master's degrees, and only 1 in 10 of PhDs. So in other words, they were dropping out. That represented, quote, a loss of ground as compared with the 1930s, when 2 out of 5 BAs and MAs and 1 out of 7 PhDs were earned by women. For remedies, the commission looked to the education subcommittee, many of whose members were working in new college programs to support adult women returning to college. Overall, the report called for more flexible means of delivering schooling, expanded vocational training, freer admissions and residency requirements, credit for life experience, and broader financial aid for women. The discussion of education, as I showed before, came in the opening section of the report, followed by recommendations from the other subcommittees. For instance, Home and Community called for wider family services and childcare with corresponding tax deductions. Labor Standards and Security of Basic Income offered crisp recommendations for fair labor standards, the right to organize, and Social Security and maternity benefits. Women Under the Law pushed for securing women's rights without the actual ERA and encouraged voting rights, jury service, married women's property rights, and public service by women. Overall, the President's Commission was cautious in its analysis and its recommendations. Most often, it advocated tinkering with problem areas, but rarely pushed for major change. Even when addressing education with its growing sense of potential, the commission stopped short of demanding equality of outcome, pushing instead simply for expanded options. Now let's turn to our other work, The Feminine Mystique. I love this picture of Betty Friedan. So staged. If the report of the President's Commission was careful, fact-driven, and balanced, Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique was generally different. Her work is filled with passion and provocation as it careens from point to point and story to story. There was, in fact, a very thoughtful plan guiding her book. It first highlighted the inchoate dissatisfaction felt by American post-war women, then traced its origins and concluded with a set of remedies. Along the way, Friedan cited statistics, research, and popular analyses. She conducted questionnaires and interviews with hundreds of women. She relied on her own training in psychology to explain the impact of Freudianism. And above all, Friedan turned to the women she knew best, suburban, college-educated wives and mothers, who were the primary victims of what she called the problem that has no name. Even today, for us, the feminine mystique exerts a certain power, starting with what I find to be an almost hypnotic opening paragraph. The problem lay buried, unspoken for many years in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone, as she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night. She was afraid to ask, even of herself, the silent question, is this all? I find the prose effective because Friedan speaks directly to her readers and she speaks as one of them, identifying as a victim of the post-war blandishments of advertising, psychology, and education. Now, in the book's 10th anniversary edition, Friedan attributed the genesis of the feminine mystique to her own continuing puzzlement over results from a questionnaire completed by her 1942 Smith College classmates, hearing in them a deep but unexplained dissatisfaction. Friedan had tried out her ideas in an article that she offered to McCall's Ladies' Home Journal and Red Book, but each one rejected the work, leading her to focus instead on the book, which she described as writing in a driven, quote, truly mystical state. She told readers how over 5 years she arranged babysitters and traveled into New York City 3 days a week to write at a desk in the New York Public Library. This description helped fuel Friedan's identification with readers, but the image was not entirely accurate. As you know from your colleague, Daniel Horowitz, he has shown in Betty Friedan and the writing of The Feminine Mystique, Friedan had a long history as a radical thinker and author, writing for a radical labor journal in her post-college years. She advocated communist causes for many years before she married and was deeply involved in radical circles. Even during her years at home, she was an active writer, and her estranged husband, Carl, said later that she always had a maid. Horowitz's analysis reminds us that the 1960s women's movement hardly grew instantly. Instead, as Friedan's experience indicates, the movement had roots in radical and social causes that developed over several decades. However, even if Friedan's life bore little resemblance to the mystique she described, she nonetheless caught a spirit of the era in both her descriptions and her recommendations. Friedan's opening chapters describe contemporary women's predicament, led to believe that their highest fulfillment lies in the role of, quote, happy housewife. Women, she argued, married now at younger ages, dropped out of school, soon bore children, and devoted themselves to family, all to the detriment of their own psychological and emotional growth. When they began to feel a vague dissatisfaction with such a circumscribed life, experts told them they were maladjusted and simply not feminine enough. Interspersed with these analyses were Friedan's numerous stories, snippets of individual women's lives, which reveal both unhappiness and a disturbing commitment to an ideally feminized life. For instance, after a discussion about early marriage and the impact of birth control, Friedan says, quote, "In a New York hospital, a woman had a nervous breakdown when she found she could not breastfeed her baby. In other hospitals, women dying of cancer refused a drug, which research had proved might save their lives. Its side effects were said to be unfeminine." A reader can hardly argue with these. The middle sections of the book cite the culprit, Freudian thinking, which emphasized the power of sexuality. This impact was extended by those Friedan called functionalist social scientists, who promoted a particular role for women in modern society. That is, they in the world would function best when women cared for the family. These scientists argued that when women protested or chafed against their role, their maladjustment played out in the ills Friedan described. Now further, in a misguided effort to help women, colleges and schools soon became filled with what they called sex-directed educators, who rather than see women prepare for a life that they couldn't lead, worked to match women's education to their actual situations. Now, like the President's Commission, Friedan circled around to the importance of education. In explaining how women had been lulled into their dilemma, she asserted that education was the prime target of the new mystique for its role in preparing women for larger lives. She noted that if the Freudians and the functionalists were right, educators were guilty of defeminizing American women, of dooming them to frustration as housewives and mothers or to celibate careers. To Friedan, these educators had committed a twofold offense. First, by actively educating girls to their sexual function rather than other opportunity, and second, by abdicating their responsibility for the education of women. So in other words, she found that educators made some decisions in order to try to keep women from falling into the mystique, but then they themselves fell into the mystique. So you have to, I realize that sometimes the quotes can seem confusing because she conflates the two here. Friedan expressed sympathy for the young women who had been misled, understanding that they were simply defending themselves from future disappointment. She quoted one pretty sophomore, "The idea is to be casual, very sophisticated. Don't be too enthusiastic about your work or anything. People who take things too seriously are more or less pitied or laughed at." So Friedan described how the role of housewife had been foisted upon women and poignantly described what she called the forfeited self that women gave up to play a role that did not fit their true needs. Here she created some of her most provocative images, calling lives, such lives, quote, "a comfortable concentration camp where women are suffering a slow death of mind and spirit." Having drawn this dramatic and gloomy picture, Friedan concluded with her ideas for remediation, what she called her new life plan for women. The first step was for women and men to realize that contemporary expectations were not satisfying women's intellectual, emotional, or physical energies. Rather, each woman must find rewarding work that allows her to build a career. Friedan treated career quite broadly, explaining it as, quote, "the lifelong commitment to an art or science, to politics or profession, not tied to a specific job or locale, but with year-to-year variation. So it depended on whether or not a woman could work full-time, part-time, or not at all." Friedan recognized that change would not be easy. Once again, she filled paragraphs with stories of women who, in taking risks, lost husbands, alienated friends, or became ill from stress. But she also offered models of women who successfully resisted the feminine mystique. And the one commonality she found among those who prospered was collegiate education. Quote, "The feminine mystique has made higher education for women seem suspect, unnecessary, and even dangerous. But I think that education and only education has saved and can continue to save American women. The remedy must go beyond individuals," she explained, quote, "There are implications of the feminine mystique that must be faced on a national scale. Comparing women to soldiers who, on returning from World War II, were given educational opportunities through the GI Bill, Friedan suggested a similar program through which women could resume their education or reinvigorate their intellects. She suggested a 6-week course of, quote, intellectual shock therapy, where women would be subsidized to attend college during a summer refresher course to study the importance of the humanities. Afterwards, traditional colleges and universities would provide new opportunities for them as returning older students, just like those that were encouraged by the President's Commission. Friedan ended with an expression of faith in women's ability to resist the feminine mystique, to seek new educational opportunities, and to assume lives of commitment. Quote, "The time is at hand when the voices of the feminine mystique can no longer drown out the inner voice that is driving women on to become complete." So for my last section, let me talk about comparing the two books and what I think they tell us about how to think about women in 1963 and how to think like a feminist in that time. As different as these two books are, they each tell us a great deal about women's agency in 1963. And although they differ in tone and recommendations, they overlap in topics covered, models offered, and people involved in each project. In terms of the people, several contributors knew each other through work or acquaintance. Friedan, for instance, was already known for her popular writing, and she contributed to that background consultation on the media for the President's Commission. Now, there she played only a small role, where her views centered on the power of women's magazines to idealize women's lives. However, her ideas were more influential in the deliberations of the President's Commission Subcommittee on Education, to the chagrin of some members. Let me tell you about that story. As the Education Subcommittee finalized its report, two of its members cited the feminine mystique as a potentially useful model for gaining attention for the President's Commission's work. Physician Sidney Farber and Dr. Virginia Senders, who was a psychologist responsible for the new Women's Continuing Education Program at the University of Minnesota, enthusiastically cited Friedan. Now, that committee had labored to find its voice, and Dr. Farber had worried that using too mild or conciliatory a tone would cause the public simply to ignore the work. At one meeting, he asked in frustration, "Who the devil is going to read this?" Senders agreed with him, and she said, "Let's use the feminine mystique as a model for its ability to get people's attention, especially men's, by irritating them." Now, the subcommittee chair, however, was quite disinclined to follow Friedan. Mary Bunting, president of Radcliffe, had followed an approach to women's issues quite different from Friedan's, and her caution won out. A few years earlier, Bunting and Friedan had had the opportunity to work together. While Bunting was dean of Douglas College, she and Friedan considered co-authoring a book on women. However, Bunting felt that they differed too strongly on what she called Friedan's bitterness toward men. In Bunting's view, Friedan blamed men for women's concerns, whereas Bunting herself resisted such an oppositional approach. For Bunting, the blame more appropriately fell on what she called, quote, "a climate of unexpectation for women." This climate affected females at an early age, with people always expecting less of them than of boys, and of worsening as the girls reached college. Since few really expected girls to contribute much to the intellectual and professional worlds, young women received little encouragement and few resources. Eventually, when the lure of marriage and motherhood drew women away from college, few were concerned enough to protest. As Bunting explained, quote, "All too often, academic advisors do not believe that the loss of a young female scholar is of any real significance. She's bright, but not important." The tension between Bunting's and Friedan's beliefs encapsulates the difference between approaches to women in 1963. Friedan's view was less common, although it would come to be identified as the new feminism by the mid-1960s. As Bunting said later, Friedan caught that tide beautifully. But earlier, few women, especially those who had reached positions of authority or prominence, were likely to blame men or to cite overt discrimination for women's slower progress. Throughout the commission's work, for instance, Bunting was uncomfortable with others' tendency to assign blame. Like advocates of protective labor legislation, Bunting supported compensatory programs that would fix problems for women, but she generally believed that comparisons to men were not useful. Rather, the nation needed good policy that, by helping all, would help women. Such differences of approach highlighted what would later be called an equality versus equity argument, or the same different debate among feminists. Here the question was whether women should be treated the same, equally, as men, and let their talents and strengths carry them, or whether their differences should be recognized and ameliorated, eventually creating equality. These divergent viewpoints signal a second difference between the two books, the question of whether women should compete with men. Friedan was perfectly comfortable with women competing in the same venues with men once they had received the proper training. Friedan chastised Bunting for suggesting, as did many psychologists, that women would succeed best by avoiding direct competition and seeking their own areas of strength. She disdained Bunting's argument, and this I quote from Bunting, that women, because they are not generally the principal breadwinners, can be perhaps most useful as the trailblazers, working along the bypaths, doing the unusual job that men cannot afford to gamble on. There is always room on the fringes. Although Bunting's statement does show her careful analysis that women can find intellectual freedom in less familiar areas, Friedan saw this as consigning women to the fringes. Friedan bluntly stated, quote, "It's better for a woman to compete impersonally in society as men do than to compete for dominance in her own home with her husband, compete with her neighbors for empty status, and so smother her son that he cannot compete at all." This view of the competition among neighbors and in the home reveals a third striking difference between Friedan and the commission, the role of motherhood and work in the lives of women. The President's Commission, even though organized primarily around economic concerns, struggled against giving the impression that it valued paid work over family life. The subcommittees on education and on home and community became repository for the Commission's family values. The home and community section, for example, opened with a clear statement that, quote, "The Commission recognizes the fundamental responsibility of mothers and homemakers and society's stake in family life, in strong family life. In a post-war world where stabilizing family life was key, women played a significant and necessary role." Friedan, however, had lost patience with this approach. For her, motherhood and homemaking had assumed undue power, crowding out women's other opportunities. Ultimately, Friedan called for a blend of involvements, but urged women to burst out of the, quote, "deep sleep" that false promises had created. Finally, the greatest difference between the two books centered on their solutions for women. And this is a divergence that demonstrates 1963 as a moment for change. The Commission, as the first national study on women, understood the varied pressures on women. Unwilling to minimize the importance of home and family, even while seeking to expand women's workplace opportunities, the Commission turned to the notion of individual choice. As I noted earlier, its report had opened by saying, quote, "The freedom to choose among different life patterns is one of the greatest opportunities in a democracy." Yet it emphasized the individual calculus that each woman and each family must make, saying, quote, "Innumerable private solutions found by different individuals in search of the good life provide society with basic strength far beyond the possibilities of a dictated plan." Now, this commitment to innumerable private solutions explains the Commission's reliance on education. Education would provide the tools women needed to make choices and achieve solutions. Limiting women's education would prohibit their free choice. Thus, emphasizing appropriate schooling for all allowed the Commission to advance women's options without dictating a particular plan. Friedan rejected such privatism. She argued that the very lack of organized help kept women from fulfilling themselves, saying, quote, "This is not just the private problem of each individual woman. There are implications of the feminine mystique that must be faced on a national scale." She challenged the Commission's approach of providing basic choice for all, calling instead for, quote, "a drastic reshaping of the cultural image of femininity." In this last point, we can see the beginnings of a new feminism that grew after 1963. What distinguished the quiet, unacknowledged feminism of the President's Commission from the feistier movement very soon to come was this difference between individual and collective solutions. Women who had succeeded in the post-war period had generally done so as exceptions to the prevailing expectations. Friedan even called them mutations. In an era with so deep a sense of obligation to home and family, each woman made her own way through decisions about education, career, and motherhood. What Friedan articulated, the tide that she caught, in Bunting's words, was growing dissatisfaction with such individual solutions and a readiness for collective response. But understanding that the President's Commission supported women and sought their fulfillment, even though its solutions may seem to us dated and unadventurous, acknowledges the power of context and the influence of multiple expectations in the early 1960s. In many ways, the Commission's commitment to women's issues provided the base upon which more radical analyses, like Friedan's, could flourish. I couldn't resist this Smith picture. The challenges to women's agency and activism in a complicated time like 1963 were enormous. As we look back from a post-feminist perspective, it is easy to assume that Friedan's analysis was the more clear and convincing, and that her sense of agency was the more powerful. But, like the differences between protective labor legislation and the ERA, the choice of pursuing incremental or rapid change, or even perhaps of reform versus revolution, required careful consideration by all who tried to support women in 1963. We will do well to acknowledge the complex nature of that moment. Thank you.